This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, Scotch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio, and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new film Spider-Man Homecoming. I'm also going to be talking about some smaller films like The Little Hours and The Hero and Okja, which is just released on Netflix. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, box office predictions, and of course, the home cinema roundup featuring a look back at the classic pirate comedy Yellowbeard. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. If you want to reach out to me on the internet, I'm at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/kevincarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
It's been kind of a slow news week for movie news, mainly because the 4th of July was this week, and Hollywood's just like Congress. It just takes the entire week off. So, nothing really big has happened, and, you know, with 4th of July falling in the middle of the week, which was a Tuesday, there's really no big news that is really hitting this week. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the hype and blowback to the blowback for popular movies that get a lot of buzz. And I'm speaking of this because of Baby Driver, which is a fun little film. And if you recall, I gave it a kind of rocks. I thought it was a lot of fun. But if you listen to the hype that went on, people are treating this movie like it cures cancer. And these are one of the things where I like to tell people to pump the brakes, because one of the things I said as I reviewed this movie on the radio around the country, I remember saying, okay, look, don't listen to the hype, because the hype is by people who absolutely love Edgar Wright. And look, I like Edgar Wright too. I think he is a great director and he has some really interesting stuff, but you got to realize from a Hollywood standpoint, he doesn't exactly have a great track record. In fact, the highest grossing movie that Edgar Wright's ever had was Scott Pilgrim versus the World, which was $31.5 million is what it grossed. But that was a notorious bomb. And the reason for that was it was a very expensive movie to make. Relatively, it was $60 million. And worldwide, it didn't even make 50, which is odd because I'm sure it did pretty well in England, but elsewhere. It just was not the big comic book movie that they were hoping it would be. But even then, if you look at what he's best known for, Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz. Shaun of the Dead made $13.5 million in the United States, which isn't very much at all. And Hot Fuzz made just under $25. Hot Fuzz made a little bit better in the foreign market, but Shaun of the Dead matched its domestic haul with about, you know, like $16.5 million. It made about $30 million worldwide. Now, granted, Shaun of the Dead was 13 years ago. But the reality is Edgar Wright has always been niche. Even in Europe, he's niche. And I think he has great stuff. But he's a quintessential example of that artist who does not do mainstream work. And something like the reviews on Baby Driver, and I said this last week, I said that it was him Americanizing his style, and that's cool. And it worked to a degree. It certainly did. Because Baby Driver now, when I'm done speaking this sentence, it's way beyond even what the final haul was for Scott Pilgrim versus the World. It made, and this is teasing a little bit of the box office later, but it made $30 million in its 5-day opening, which is perfectly great, and that's amazing for this movie, especially when you consider the fact that Baby Driver only cost $34 million to make. But here's the thing. I've seen tons of stories talking about how, oh, it's an original movie, and people are dying to see original. They want original movies. Look how badly all these other movies have done. Look how low these performances are for these other movies. People want original movies. That's arguably not the case. Arguably, there's a much greater demand for Transformers 5 this summer than there was for Baby Driver. Because even though Transformers 5 isn't doing very well compared to the other Transformers movies, It made twice what Baby Driver made in 5 days, and it did it over three. And yes, the holding power of Transformers 2 is not going to be as strong, and there are people who are going to continue to discover Baby Driver, but the same thing goes for The Mummy. There was a greater demand to see a Tom Cruise Mummy movie than there was to see Baby Driver. The reason Baby Driver is a hit, I'm not taking away its hit status, but this is more about risk to return. This is more about the fact that this guy's never been able to open a movie over 10 million, and now he's got a movie that's opened with 30. And this isn't about that this is a movie that's original. It's the fact that he was able to make this movie for about 35 million, and he's going to more than make his money back, as opposed to something like Scott Pilgrim, which cost 60 million and didn't even make that in global box office. I mean, it's not like when the Avengers came out, that changed the landscape of movies. When Avatar came out, that changed the landscape of movies. When Jurassic World came out and made $200 million opening weekend, changed the look of these movies. These were huge demand movies. And they were sequels or series, and those made 10 times as much as a movie like this does. Again, not to take that away from Baby Driver or its success, but don't go making the case that people then want to see a ton of movies like Baby Driver when the movie's got a decent box office for a small opening. You can take that analysis and put it to movies like Wonder Woman or the original Guardians of the Galaxy and say, look, people don't just want to see another superhero that we've seen a billion times before. We want new and original superheroes. And that's why Wonder Woman and Guardians of the Galaxy, the first one, were making over $300 million. Those are bona fide hits that are playing up against the big boys. You really can't compare Baby Driver to the giant box office juggernauts that we see in the movie theaters. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. These are two Christmas openings or holiday openings that we're going to be talking about here, because we're coming over the hill for the summer movies and they want to get you prepared going downhill to the Christmas movies and the holiday releases this summer. First one I want to talk about is Bad Moms Christmas.
I don't think I can do this sober.
You guys want to get drunk at the food court?
Ooh, yeah. I do this how
I like. I'm D-Bo. I feel like a giant stress ball from like November to New Year's.
Yeah. I spend months picking out the perfect present for everyone. You know, the only thing I get in return? Coupons for free back rubs.
That's not okay.
Bad back rubs.
Remember when the holidays were actually fun?
Let's take Christmas back.
You know, I really liked Bad Moms. I thought it was a funny movie. I thought it worked for what it was. At the very least, from the trailer, it looks like it's trying to have the same approach. With tackling Christmas, at least they are trying something new, something different than just once again tackling the overzealous mom on the PTA. So this one looks very similar. It looks like very much a continuation of the first one. So I imagine this one's going to be pretty good. Let's just hope that the full film works as well as the trailer does. The next one I want to talk about is The Greatest Showman, opens on December 25th.
P.T. Barnum, at your service. I'm putting together a show. No apologies. And I need a star. Every one of us is special. Nobody is like anyone else. That's the point of my show.
I can't just run off and join the circus.
Why not? I mean, you clearly have a flair for show business.
For show business?
Mm-hmm.
I've never heard of it.
Because I just invented it.
I don't know if this is a musical or not. I mean, it says it has musical numbers to it, which does bother me. And that's sort of that overly contemporary. So I hate that song that plays in the trailer. I mean, it looks like it's beautifully shot, but it also looks like it's trying to channel a bit of Moulin Rouge. And I don't know if you can channel Moulin Rouge. Moulin Rouge is its own thing. So, I don't know. The jury's out on this one. I mean, I think it's odd that this is coming out, because didn't Barnum and Bailey just close down? It's just an odd time for this one. It just feels awkward. And, you know, of course it drops La La Land as a name somewhere at the end of the credits, which I think we're done with La La Land by now. We'll wait till Christmas to get a full count on whether these are good movies. And that is it. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Little Hours and The Hero.
Stop it now.
Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about some movies this week. Let's talk about the movies, the new movies, the ones that I'm going to talk about and review. And we're going to start with a couple of them that actually have been making their way through the releases. The Little Hours, which actually opened, I believe it opened last week. In like New York and LA, but it's on its limited release, and it's, I believe, opening this week in my hometown of Columbus, Ohio. And that is a comedy. A medieval nunnery is thrown into a tizzy when a young man escaping assassination comes to live with them.
These are your sins. Abusive language.
They spit on me. They called me a Jew.
Lustfulness. Homosexuality.
This is not tight.
Did you roll your eyes?
Is it true that you've never been touched by a man?
No, never.
It's the greatest pleasure on earth.
What is wrong with her?
She is on drugs!
It's the longest list I've ever had. Apostasy, abusive language, heresy, revelings, eating blood. Do you think I've ever written down eating blood before? Where am I?
The hardest sell on this is to make people aware it's a comedy. Because all of the stills and all of the clips that I've seen make it look like a drama. And it's not. It is, in a way, a very absurd comedy without anything that looks absurd in the movie. Because it's all about the performances and the deliveries. And you've got, like, Aubrey Plaza, who is, I mean, she's actually done a lot of stuff lately. But she kind of was first known and come on the scene very strongly as the smart mouth, foul mouth friend of somebody. And you saw that in we talked about Scott Pilgrim versus the World earlier, and you saw her in Funny People. And that's kind of the shtick that she had on stage. And then, of course, that was spun into Parks and Recreation with the character of April Lovegate. And she's branched out a bit to do a little bit more heartfelt things, some actually more dramatic stuff. But this is her playing that stock character where she's very aggressive and she yells, and they use a lot of contemporary language. And that's what makes it funny. And part of it also is the other people that are involved in it. You've got like Molly Shannon playing the Reverend Mother. Is that who runs the nunnery? And you also have, like Kate Micucci, who is best known for being like being the awkward girl in movies or TV shows. She was in like Scrubs and she was on The Big Bang Theory. She's half of Garfunkel and Oates, which is that she plays like a ukulele. I mean, I found her very funny and I've loved her stuff ever since she kind of really came on the scene maybe 10 years or so or more ago. But she gets a chance to kind of really have a spotlight, and she's very funny because she just kind of played her stock character of being kind of meek, but also can be very crazy at times. The cast is what makes this work, but all the jokes are very subtle. A lot of the jokes are very subtle. They're delivered in dialogue or they're thrown out there, and they don't. One of the things that American audiences don't respond to very well is when they just toss a joke out there and hope people get it. A lot of American audiences, especially like wide mainstream American audiences, they want the joke telegraphed to them and they want somebody to almost put a rim shot at the end of it just to show, oh yeah, you're supposed to laugh. That's why it took so long for TV to not have laugh tracks on sitcoms. And I'm talking about stuff like MASH. When they did MASH has a laugh track. And the reason MASH has a laugh track is because the American audience, the American TV audience, especially in the 70s and 80s, needed to be told, you need a laugh here. And they don't do that in movies because you have the audience of a movie to for everyone to react to. And The Little Hours has a lot of funny bits to it that are hilarious, but they're not always telegraphed. It has some great performances. It's out there. It's bizarre. It is not mainstream, but it is very funny. And especially like anybody else involved, Alison Brie's in it. You've got John C. Reilly. You've got David Franco. You've got, I almost said Ron Swanson, but it's Nick Offerman. I mean, so it's got a great cast and it feels like this brilliant little experiment that's going to go nowhere. I mean, I fear nobody's going to get this movie. But it's dry American humor, which you don't always get to see. Usually that's stamped on as a British thing, but it's actually works. So I'm going to have to say The Little Hours kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the hero. Sam Elliott plays an aging Western star who faces a cancer diagnosis and a career resurgence.
Have you ever heard of the Western Appreciation Guild? They want to give you a Lifetime Achievement Award.
Lifetime, huh? Anything else? A job offer? A script?
Not at the moment.
Dad, what are you doing here?
I guess it's been a while, huh?
I gotta get back.
Are you okay? You seem a little off.
I did one film that I'm proud of. That was 40 years ago. Since then, I wouldn't say I've been achieving.
I'm assuming part of this is maybe at least semi-autobiographical with Sam Elliott, because Sam Elliott, even though he's not always a Western star, I mean, I've seen movies where he's not a Western star. He pretty much is the quintessential Western guy. I mean, a lot of people, you say the most Western looking person, a lot of people say John Wayne. He could play a cowboy, but he also played like an army sergeant and stuff. Sam Elliott, like he was in the movie, the Ang Lee's version of the Hulk, and he played Betty Ross's father. He had fatigues on the whole time, but you still looked at him and said, he needs a cowboy hat. Because he's Sam Elliott. And I went back and I watched the movie, I think it was The Legacy, which is from the late 70s. I mean, like Roger Daltrey's in it and Catherine Ross. And he's just, I think he's a photographer in there and he rides a motorcycle, but he looks like he belongs in a Western. And the older he's gotten, the more he looks like the Western. Like if you remember in The Big Lebowski, is the quintessential, I'm just going to show up and be the mysterious stranger. I mean, even more than like Clint Eastwood, because Clint Eastwood can play a cop. If Sam Elliott plays a cop, he looks like he should have a cowboy hat on. And that's the image that makes this movie work. Now, it does tend to go down very similar paths. I mean, I've seen a dozen movies about a person aging in life, especially if it's a celebrity, who has a cancer diagnosis and doesn't want to tell their estranged family. I mean, we're seeing a lot of the same tropes and story ideas and plot lines. And so it doesn't feel terribly original. It's just kind of fun to watch Sam Elliott be Sam Elliott. And he's really the glue that holds us together. If you made the, because the whole thing is he's this aging Western star and he's getting this award, this Lifetime Achievement Award. But it's right after he learns that he has like pancreatic cancer, which if you don't know anything about pancreatic cancer, usually pancreatic cancer is extremely aggressive and fast. And I've known a couple people who've had pancreatic cancer who they're gone within weeks of finding that out. In fact, I had a friend who his mother got pancreatic cancer. He was from Indonesia, so they do things a little differently over there. And they literally told the family not to tell her what the diagnosis was because she was going to die so fast. They didn't want her to freak out. That is how aggressive pancreatic cancer is, and the survival rates are so low. And that is a blow you're going to get, even with the character in the movie who's 71. The big problem is that he has this estranged wife, played by his real-life wife, Catherine Ross, and he's got an estranged daughter, played by Kristen Ritter, and that tends to be very routine, but it works as a movie that's a spotlight on a very specific star dealing with a lot of what he probably has to deal with as a Western guy who doesn't have very many options as an actor because they don't make very many Westerns anymore. So I'm going to have to say it kind of rocks. It's just right on the cusp there because it's trite and I've seen a lot of this before, but it was great to watch Sam Elliott for an hour and a half.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Spider-Man Homecoming. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kuykendall Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
Spider-Man, does whatever a spider can. Spins a web any size, catches thieves just like flies. Look out! Here comes the Spider-Man!
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr, continuing on with the movie reviews. We're going to talk about the big one of the week, and that is Spider-Man Homecoming. But I've also brought in another movie reviewer. Over the last couple months, I have brought my son Nicholas on when there's been a movie that was good for kids. Like, we did it last week with Despicable Me 3. I did it a couple weeks ago with Captain Underpants and with Diary of a Wimpy Kid and with Cars 3. And it seems to do well. It's nice to get a different perspective. And since, you know, that's why you have kids. They're basically your slaves. They can come on and do this and, be a radio personality. And I don't have to get anybody's permission because I'm their father. So during that whole thing, after that had happened with Nicholas, my other son, Ben, who's 14, was expressing concern that he hasn't had his voice heard and he wants to have his voice heard. Now, he's been on the show before, but the last time he was on the show was probably 2008. So he was a little bit younger, a little bit smaller then. But I said, I'll tell you what, you can come on since Spider-Man, it's a high school movie, you know, it takes place in high school, it's something that high school kids are going to like. Let's bring him on for Spider-Man Homecoming. So I have with me in the magical studio in the sky, Benjamin Carr. Say hello, Ben.
Hello.
Oh, yeah, see, now your voice, you sound less like a child than when you did before.
Definitely.
You know, yeah. When you were little and I had you on once before, I think it was the last time I had you on was when you reviewed Hugo.
I think so.
Yeah, that was the one, the Martin Scorsese film. I had both you and your brother on. But even before that, I remember I had you, and you like wandered away in the middle of the show and you like went to the bathroom and you could hear me having to tell you how to get to the bathroom because you didn't care. You were like four.
Yeah.
You're 14.
Yes.
And you are into movies.
Yes,
I am. What's the favorite thing you're into?
Sci-fi or horror. It's like, they're very exciting movies.
Genre movies.
Mm-hmm.
None of that rom-com nonsense.
Well, I like rom-coms, but I mean, I wouldn't choose them over like a sci-fi or horror movie.
Okay. All right. Well, now here's a big question. Do you think that superhero movies like Spider-Man, do you think that's a bona fide sci-fi movie?
I would think so because, I mean, it's like, it's in a world that's not of our own and like has sci-fi elements, like superpowers. That's definitely a sci-fi thing.
Spiders and.
Yeah, that's a sci-fi.
People flying around in magical, not magical, but science suits.
Yes.
Right. Okay. All right. So let's go ahead and play the trailer for Spider-Man Homecoming and then we'll talk a little bit about it. Peter Parker must reconcile being a teenager in high school with his occasional inclusion with the Avengers.
These weapons are crazy dangerous.
Listen, Peter, there are people who handle this sort of thing.
Can't you just be a friendly neighborhood Spider-Man?
Let go of me! Let go of me!
Activating parachute.
The world's changing, boys.
It's time we change, too.
This is my chance to prove myself.
We have a Spanish quiz.
You gotta get better at this part of the job.
I don't understand.
I want to get your opinion on this movie, but first of all, what have you thought of Spider-Man as a character, either as a comic book character or in cartoons? Because I don't know if you've read many of the comic books.
No.
But you've seen some of the cartoons.
Mm-hmm. I don't remember, like, other than the first one that much. But, I mean, I think it was a good start. Like, most movies have good starts, but then they're rebooted as something not so good.
The Amazing Spider-Man, which you didn't see. This is the third time we've had a new Spider-Man movie, and even though Spider-Man appeared in Captain America: Civil War, did you like how they introduced him in Captain America: Civil War?
Yes, I did.
you thought that was a neat little inclusion.
Finally.
This one is the first standalone Spider-Man movie in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And that's significant to people out there. And a lot of people say, why do we need another Spider-Man movie? Because not everybody follows the which movie universe it is. And there's a lot of people who don't quite understand why this is different than The Amazing Spider-Man. And the big reason is because of all the other Avengers who've already been established.
Yes.
In the existing movies. So tell me what your opinion was of just this movie, not just as a movie itself, but also how it fit in with the Avengers.
Well, the movie itself was, I mean, it's different. Other movies are just like, some of them are subtly annexing themselves into the universe, but some of them, like this movie, is sort of like its own standalone, but it also has other affiliations with the universe that's tied to.
Like Tony Stark showing up. I mean, he's not a main character. That's one of the things I liked about this, is that Tony Stark in this movie, you wouldn't know from the marketing, because of course they want to market this as saying this is a Marvel Cinematic Universe movie. So there's a lot of Tony Stark in the trailers and in the posters, but pretty much you've seen everything that Tony Stark's in. There's a couple extra stuff, but most of Tony Stark's is already, you know what he's doing because you've seen him in the trailers, but they need to let the regular audience know, hey, this is actually a Marvel movie with the Iron Man character and everything like that. I like the fact that they didn't do too much with Iron Man. I like the fact that it didn't become Spider-Man and Iron Man saving the day all the time.
Yeah.
Iron Man shows up, Tony Stark shows up, but it's very much Spider-Man's movie.
Yeah.
Were you bothered at all by there not being an origin story?
I was not bothered at all, because I think by now we have established what Spider-Man's origins are.
Yeah.
We don't need another Spider-Man origin story.
Spider-Man oranges story?
Spider-Man oranges.
Well, yeah, because that was one of my big complaints about The Amazing Spider-Man when they rebooted that 5 years ago, is the first half of the movie was essentially just a reshoot of the first movie, which we didn't need. Everybody saw what happened. Now, when you have a movie like Doctor Strange, you need to go through that guy's origin, because not everybody knows who that is. But I think we can pretty much assume people know Spider-Man. And if you don't, it's pretty obvious from his name.
Yeah.
It's not like I'm Spider-Man. Oh, what can you do? Well, I can fly and shoot lasers out of my eyes and go, well, that's not spider powers. But then you say, well, what are you, Spider-Man? Oh, I can climb up walls. Mm-hmm. I can spin a web any size. I capture thieves just like flies, you know.
Yeah.
He can throw down a beat, even though he doesn't.
Sadly.
One of the things I really enjoyed about this movie was the fact that it was Peter Parker's own movie.
Yeah.
And in this, Peter Parker, he's not quite Spider-Man yet. It's very imperfect.
Yeah.
And this is funny, because I'll talk to you understand this, because you're 14. Mm-hmm. And Peter Parker's what in this movie, 15?
Yeah, 15.
Do you think it was a fair portrayal of a nerd at that age?
Yes, very much.
you take that personally?
Very.
I mean, he screws up a lot, and he does stuff, and he's kind of clumsy about it.
Yeah.
I thought it really kind of captured what it's like to be at that age, because one of the things with you personally is and I was showing this to your grandmother on the 4th of July, I said, if you look at the way you are now, just physically and how you look and compare you to what you were a year and a half ago, I mean, totally different person.
Yeah.
You look different. Your hair's different. You got glasses. You got your braces off. But even then, you've got bigger. You're as tall as me now, and your arms are long. You've suddenly gotten a longer arm, and you don't quite know how to use that arm. And yes. I think that's what part of the clumsiness is.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine if you could have spider powers in the process as well. Not only.
I can just imagine like tripping over the trash can and then accidentally shooting a web, or like,
because you haven't quite refined how to use your powers.
Yeah.
Spider-Man has you have walking.
I have walking ability.
I also like the humor. What do you think about the humor in the movie?
It was very like relatable, especially to me, because like I know what it's like to be in that life, and I know what it's
You're
like.
You're talking nerds again?
Yes.
Yeah, that's okay. I was a nerd too.
I can put myself in their shoes, and especially the humor is very relatable, especially because like it's got things that I like.
Well, but also the humor I felt really works in the Marvel setting. Marvel movies all have humor to them.
Yeah.
And I felt that this certainly captured that. And without being not a slapstick comedy, but there's uncomfortable teenage awkwardness in this movie, which I think is good.
Yes.
It gives Spider-Man somewhere to go.
Yeah.
He's not like a brilliant superhero. He, even though he's one of the biggest superheroes in the Marvel universe, and now he's in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, he's still got a lot of catching up to do to get to Iron Man.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's give the grade. What did you think?
I think it rocks.
I'm going to have to say Spider-Man Homecoming totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent. We need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be reviewing Okja, talking about the weekend box office and the home cinema roundup featuring Yellow Bee.
Life is a great big hang-up. Wherever there's a hang-up, you'll find a Spider-Man.
Take a seasonal trip to the zombie apocalypse. Kevin Carr's new novelettes, Not the End and Gobble, offer a new take on the zombie nightmare. In Not the End, a man wakes up from a coma to find a viral outbreak has sent the world on the defensive. He must escape and learn the true nature of the zombies. The story Gobble takes the readers back to the beginning of the outbreak, which erupts at a tense Thanksgiving dinner. Not the End and Gobble by Kevin Carr are available now. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Continue on with the movie review. This is a movie that's it actually released. I mean, a lot of people have probably had a chance. Well, everyone's had a chance to see it. It's been out there for about a week. And it's one of those that released on Netflix. And of course, when Netflix releases stuff, a lot of times it's like a Tuesday or sometimes it's a Friday. It just depends on when they decide to do it. But this movie is the film Okja, which is directed by Bong Joon-ho, who is best known for recently doing the movie Snowpiercer, which starred Chris Evans and Tilda Swinton. And it was actually a pretty big American release, bigger, of course, in South Korea, which is where Bong's from. He's a visionary director. He did other movies like Mother, and he did The Host, if you remember The Host, not that awful thing written by Stephanie Meyer, but the Korean movie The Host, about that weird sort of like mutant squid-like creature, which is a great little horror movie on its own. So this was made for Netflix, and Netflix had a big push. They have a couple places around the country showing like 35 millimeter prints of this. But generally, if you got a smartphone and a Netflix account, you can watch this. And that is Okja. A company genetically creates a super pig meant to feed the world, but when a girl bonds with one of them for most of her life, she tries to save it from the slaughter.
We are animal lovers. Our plan is to expose Miranda, rescue Okja, and bring her back to you.
10 years in planning, on the cusp of a product that will feed millions. And what happens? That farmer girl is going to destroy us.
You should know the situation is not good.
I know a lot of people from various areas on the political spectrum and social spectrum and even country-wise through Twitter. Now, I saw a lot of people I knew who were very much animal rights activists have trouble watching this movie because it's a movie about animal rights, and one of the themes is contemplating whether we as a species have the right to eat other species. I know several of them that they said they couldn't watch it, or they don't think they want to watch it because of that. Because there is a movie, there's a scene that involves a slaughterhouse, and it shows the dirty, ugly side of food production. And that's, I guess, one of the points of the movie. But it gets in the movie's way. And the movie itself has sort of like three or four different things it's trying to do. On one hand, it plays as this sort of absurdist comedy, because the whole thing is they're the people who created Okja want to bring her back to their place in New York and sort of show her off as the triumph and the best thing that they did. And it escapes, and it's trying to, the people who are this animal liberation group has tried to let it escape, and this little girl's trying, has bonded with it. And so there's scenes of it running wild and going crazy that it has this goofy soundtrack that makes it sound almost like a comedy. At the same time, then it's also this weird sort of E.T. type movie with the girl bonding with Okja. Sometimes it's almost like Totoro in the woods there. She's rolling around. She sleeps on its belly and that sort of thing. And then at times it's trying to give this really heavy-handed message about animal rights and whether or not we have the right to eat them. That all gets in the way. and it runs into each other, and you keep shifting gears, which makes the movie kind of hard to watch. Not because of the subject matter, but because you're constantly jarred into having to watch it in it from a different lens, and it doesn't quite work. I think that they're trying to do that purposely, but I don't think it quite works. And on top of that, one of the linchpins of this is the E.T. story of this basically boy and his dog kind of story, because it's a little girl and Okja, which is a female. So it's a girl and her Okja. And they establish very early in the film that Okja is incredibly smart. I mean, possibly like human level smart. That works because then you want to root for her, and she's aware of what's all happening. So you're like, oh, if she's able to do this through the rest of the movie, you project your own personality and your own thoughts on her. But the reality is, I mean, yeah, I've read the stories about how intelligent pigs are, and pigs are as intelligent, maybe as smart as chimpanzees, but they're still animals. And there's a huge difference between a human and a chimpanzee. There's a huge difference between a human and a pig, and a human and a dog. And the only reason that we bond so much with dogs is because thousands of years of breeding dogs have created a domesticated dog that is very, that links up really well with the human condition. Wolves aren't like that, which is where they came from. So it does sort of play a straw man argument on the whole, we shouldn't eat these animals because they're so smart. Well, yeah, if they can do physics, sure. But, you know, if they can just prove that they've got an opinion on something or can recognize symbols, that doesn't necessarily mean they're the same. So, I mean, not to dismiss the animal rights groups, but you're building your own little world and then trying to say, ah, see. So I think it's an interesting movie, and it's certainly well made, and it's got good performances. But ultimately, Okja, I think, suffers from getting in its own way. So I'm going to have to say it kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office. I already talked a little bit about Baby Driver. I don't want to say much more about that. But Despicable Me 3 made $72 million its opening weekend, which was considerably less than I said it would. I was going $100 million, but that's okay. That's still a good opening for Despicable Me 3, and it's going to just print money overseas, because these films do extremely well in Europe and Asia, in particular the Despicable Me movies. The Minions, you could release a movie of a minion farting for 2 hours, and it would probably make $200 million at least. Now, speaking of farting for 2 hours, there's also The House, which didn't even make $9 million, and that tanked. That is a terrible performance, and I think this was an ill-conceived film from the beginning. This week, I think, obviously, Spider-Man Homecoming is going to win. I think, I'm going to... $100 million? I don't know what to suggest on this. I don't think it's going to be as... It's not going to be like this $150 million, because it's essentially a spin-off Marvel movie, and that's really good. And Spider-Man movies, yeah, it could make $150 million opening weekend like Spider-Man 3 did, but I think that's overselling it. I think Spider-Man's not as unique anymore because there's so many other superheroes, but he's still a popular super character. And this movie's good. I think it's going to have good word of mouth. But I think a good, you know, solid $100 million prediction for Spider-Man Homecoming is fair. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. I want to talk today about Yellowbeard, and there's a very specific reason why I want to. You might think, well, why are you picking this random movie from 1983? And this is because I was talking to my son, you all heard from Ben, and I was talking to him after we saw Baby Driver, because he came and saw Baby Driver with me. And he's seen the Cornetto trilogy, he'd seen Shaun of the Dead, and Hot Fuzz, and The World's End. And I had said to him, this felt like Edgar Wright was Americanizing his taste. And I said, that's probably going to do well for him, but that doesn't always work. And I used as an example, I picked out Yellowbeard as a great example of trying to Americanize British tastes and it not quite working. Yellowbeard, I thought, was a great example of that because it was Graham Chapman from Monty Python. And I love Monty Python. Graham Chapman was always my favorite. It was so sad when he died back when I was in high school. But he pretty much wrote the whole thing, and he didn't direct it, but he starred in it. And, you know, let me first play the trailer and get it out of the way. Monty Python's Graham Chapman wrote and stars in this absurd send-off of pirate movies about a dreaded sea captain searching for a treasure with his mild-mannered son he didn't know he had.
Only one name makes cutthroats hoist their sails, hide their loot, and hold their noses. Yellowbeard.
be quick about it. Kill this stupid old bugger.
Oh, hold your horses.
Well, I can't kill him. He brought me up, just like a father.
Oh, you mean he's beaten you and kicked you and smashed you in the teeth?
Yeah.
No.
No.
He's been kind and gentle.
What kind of father is that? Kill him.
It had to be released in America, so they decided to put together all these different stars from America, you know, American stars. They have like Cheech and Chong in there and Madeline Kahn and Marty Feldman. Even though he's British, he certainly feels more like a Mel Brooks addition to this. And so it was this mismatch of all these different comedy styles. And when they were editing it, Graham Chapman was not allowed to be involved in the editing process because he didn't want to telegraph the jokes. He didn't want to tell people when to laugh. He wanted to just have the silly things in there. And if people got them, great, then they didn't. And this to me is a spectacular clash of American and British humor that doesn't quite work. There's some very funny things in this movie. And I wouldn't describe it as a good movie, but it is an interesting movie, and it's silly, and it's fun. And there are times when it fails spectacularly, but still there are times when I think it really does work. And it's a great sort of look into Graham Chapman's struggle as an artist before Terry Gilliam became the most famous struggling artist in Monty Python. So I'm going to have to say that Yellowbeard kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
There's only a couple things that came out this week on DVD and Blu-ray. The Zookeeper's Wife and Drone. The reason for that is it was the 4th of July. But that's it. I need to go for the week. Next week, I'm going to be talking about War for the Planet of the Apes. And until then, have a fat time at the movies.